U-D. He had spent weeks practicing this trick, but the audience saw none of the sweat and toil behind the scenes. Nor was Houdini ever nervous. He induced nervousness in others. He deliberately dragged out the time it would take to escape as a way of heightening the drama and making the audience squirm. His escapes from death, always graceful and easy, made him look like a Superman. As a person of power, you must research and practice endlessly before appearing in public, on stage, or anywhere else. Never expose the sweat and labor behind your poise. Some think such exposure will demonstrate their diligence and honesty, but it actually just makes them look weaker, as if anyone who practiced and worked at it could do what they had done, or as if they weren't really up to the job. Keep your effort and your tricks to yourself, and you seem to have the grace and ease of a god. One never sees the source of a god's power revealed. One only sees the effects. This from Adam's Curse by William Butler Yeats. A line of poetry will take us hours, maybe. Yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Keys to Power. Humanity's first notions of power came from primitive encounters with nature. The flash of lightning in the sky, a sudden flood, the speed and ferocity of a wild animal. These forces required no thinking, no planning. They awed us by their sudden appearance, their gracefulness, and their power over life and death. And this remains the kind of power we have always wanted to imitate. Through science and technology, we have recreated the speed and sublime power of nature. But something is missing. Our machines are noisy and jerky. They reveal their effort. Even the very best creations of technology cannot root out our admiration for things that move easily and effortlessly. The power of children to bend us to their will comes from a kind of seductive charm that we feel in the presence of a creature less reflective and more graceful than we are. We cannot return to such a state, but if we can create the appearance of this kind of ease, we elicit in others the kind of primitive awe that nature has always invoked in humankind. One of the first European writers to expound on this principle came from that most unnatural of environments, the Renaissance court. In The Book of the Courtier, published in 1528, Baldassare Castiglione describes the highly elaborate and codified manners of the perfect court citizen. And yet, Castiglione explains, the courtier must execute these gestures with what he calls sprezzatura, the capacity to make the difficult seem easy. He urges the courtier to practice in all things a certain nonchalance, which conceals all artistry and makes whatever one says or does seem uncontrived and effortless. We all admire the achievement of some unusual feat. But if it is accomplished naturally and gracefully, our admiration increases tenfold. Whereas to labor at what one is doing and to make bones over it shows an extreme lack of grace and causes everything, whatever it's worth, to be discounted. Much of the idea of sprezzatura came from the world of art. All the great Renaissance artists carefully kept their works under wraps. Only the finished masterpiece could be shown to the public. Michelangelo forbade even popes to view his work in progress. A Renaissance artist was always careful to keep his studios shut to patrons and public alike, not out of fear of imitation, but because to see the making of the works would mar the magic of their effect and their studied atmosphere of ease and natural beauty. The Renaissance painter Vasari, also the first great art critic, ridiculed the works of Paolo Uccello, who was obsessed with the laws of perspective. The effort Uccello spent on improving the appearance of perspective was too obvious in his work. It made his paintings ugly and labored, overwhelmed by the effort of their effects. We have the same response when we watch performers who put too much effort into their act. Seeing them trying so hard breaks the illusion. It also makes us uncomfortable. Calm, graceful performers, on the other hand, set us at ease, creating the illusion that they are not acting, but being natural and themselves, even when everything they are doing involves labor and practice. The idea of sprezzatura is relevant to all forms of power, for power depends vitally on appearances and the illusions you create. Your public actions are like artworks. They must have visual appeal, must create anticipation, even entertain. When you reveal the inner workings of your creation, you become just one more mortal among others. What is understandable is not awe-inspiring. We tell ourselves we could do as well if we had the money and time. Avoid the temptation of showing how clever you are. It is far more clever to conceal the mechanisms of your cleverness. Talleyrand's application of this concept to his daily life greatly enhanced the aura of power that surrounded him. He never liked to work too hard, so he made others do the work for him, the spying, the research, the detailed analyses. With all this labor at his disposal, he himself never seemed to strain. When his spies revealed that a certain event was about to take place, he would talk in social conversation as if he sensed its imminence. The result was that people thought he was clairvoyant. His short, pithy statements and witticisms always seemed to summarize the situation perfectly, but they were based on much research and thought. To those in government, including Napoleon himself, Talleyrand gave the impression of immense power, an effect entirely dependent on the apparent ease with which he accomplished his feats. There is another reason for concealing your shortcuts and tricks. When you let this information out, you give people ideas they can use against you. You lose the advantages of keeping silent. We tend to want the world to know what we have done. We want our vanity gratified by having our hard work and cleverness applauded. And we may even want sympathy for the hours it has taken to reach our point of artistry. Learn to control this propensity to blab, for its effect is often the opposite of what you expected. Remember, the more mystery surrounds your actions, the more awesome your power seems. You appear to be the only one who can do what you do, and the appearance of having an exclusive gift is immensely powerful. Finally, because you achieve your accomplishments with grace and ease, people believe that you could always do more if you tried harder. This elicits not only admiration, but a touch of fear. Your powers are untapped. No one can fathom their limits. Reversal. The secrecy with which you surround your actions must seem light-hearted in spirit. A zeal to conceal your work creates an unpleasant, almost paranoiac impression. You are taking the game too seriously. Houdini was careful to make the concealment of his tricks seem a game, all part of the show. Never show your work until it is finished. But if you put too much effort into keeping it under wraps, you will be like the painter Pontormo, who spent the last years of his life hiding his frescoes from the public eye and only succeeded in driving himself mad. Always keep your sense of humor about yourself. There are also times when revealing the inner workings of your projects can prove worthwhile. It all depends on your audience's taste and on the times in which you operate. P.T. Barnum recognized that his public wanted to feel involved in his shows, and that understanding his tricks delighted them, partly perhaps because implicitly debunking people who kept their sources of power hidden from the masses appealed to America's democratic spirit. The public also appreciated the showman's humor and honesty. Barnum took this to the extreme of publicizing his own humbuggery in his popular autobiography, written when his career was at its height. As long as the partial disclosure of tricks and techniques is carefully planned, rather than the result of an uncontrollable need to blab, it is the ultimate in cleverness. It gives the audience the illusion of being superior and involved, even while much of what you do remains concealed from them. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Chano Yu, the Japanese tea ceremony. Kano Tanyu, master artist. Date Masamune once sent for Tanyu to decorate a pair of gold screens 7 feet high. The artist said he thought black and white sketches would suit them, and went home again after considering them carefully. The next morning he came early and made a large quantity of ink into which he dipped a horseshoe he had brought with him. and then proceeded to make impressions of this all over one of the screens. Then with a large brush, he drew a number of lines across them. Meanwhile, Masamune had come in to watch his work, and at this he could contain his irritation no longer, and muttering, "What a beastly mess!" he strode away to his own apartment. The retainers told Tanyu he was in a very bad temper indeed. "He shouldn't look on while I am at work, then," replied the painter. "He should wait till it is finished." Then he took up a smaller brush and dashed in touches here and there, and as he did so, the prints of the horseshoe turned into crabs, while the big broad strokes became rushes. He then turned to the other screen and splashed drops of ink all over it. And when he had added a few brush strokes here and there, they became a flight of swallows over willow trees. When Masamune saw the finished work, he was as overjoyed at the artist's skill as he had previously been annoyed at the apparent mess he was making of the screens. From the story of Sadi, as told in The Craft of Power. The Wrestling Master. There was once a wrestling master who was versed in 360 feints and holds. He took a special liking to one of his pupils, to whom he taught 359 of them over a period of time. Somehow he never got around to the last trick. As months went by, the young man became so proficient in the art that he bested everyone who dared to face him in the ring. He was so proud of his prowess that one day he boasted before the Sultan that he could readily whip his master, were it not out of respect for his age and gratitude for his tutelage. The Sultan became incensed at this irreverence and ordered an immediate match with the royal court in attendance. At the gong, the youth barged forward with a lusty yell, only to be confronted with the unfamiliar 360th feint. The master seized his former pupil, lifted him high above his head, and flung him crashing to the ground. The Sultan and the assembly let out a loud cheer. When the Sultan asked the master how he was able to overcome such a strong opponent, the master confessed that he had reserved a secret technique for himself, for just such a contingency. Then he related the lamentation of a master of archery who taught everything he knew. "No one has learned archery from me," the poor fellow complained, "who has not tried to use me as a butt in the end." From Baltazar Gracian. Keep the extent of your abilities unknown. The wise man does not allow his knowledge and abilities to be sounded to the bottom, if he desires to be honored by all. He allows you to know them, but not to comprehend them. No one must know the extent of his abilities, lest he be disappointed. No one ever has an opportunity of fathoming him entirely. For guesses and doubts about the extent of his talents arouse more veneration than accurate knowledge of them, be they ever so great. The 31st Law. Control the options. Get others to play with the cards you deal. Judgment. The best deceptions are the ones that seem to give the other person a choice. Your victims feel that they are in control, but are actually your puppets. Give people options that come out in your favor, whichever one they choose. Force them to make choices between the lesser of two evils, both of which serve your purpose. Put them on the horns of a dilemma. They are gored wherever they turn. Observance of the Law Number 1. From early in his reign, Ivan the Fourth, later known as Ivan the Terrible, had to confront an unpleasant reality. The country desperately needed reform, but he lacked the power to push it through. The greatest limit to his authority came from the boyars, the Russian princely class that dominated the country and terrorized the peasantry. In 1553, at the age of 23, Ivan fell ill. Lying in bed, near death, he asked the boyars to swear allegiance to his son as the new czar. Some hesitated, some even refused. Then and there, Ivan saw he had no power over the boyars. He recovered from his illness, but he never forgot the lesson. The boyars were out to destroy him. And indeed, in the years to come, many of the most powerful of them defected to Russia's main enemies, Poland and Lithuania, where they plotted the return and the overthrow of the Tsar. Even one of Ivan's closest friends, Prince Andrei Kurbsky, suddenly turned against him, defecting to Lithuania in 1564 and becoming the strongest of Ivan's enemies. When Kurbsky began raising troops for an invasion, the royal dynasty seemed suddenly more precarious than ever. With emigre nobles fomenting invasion from the west, Tartars bearing down from the east, and the boyars stirring up trouble within the country, Russia's vast size made it a nightmare to defend. In whatever direction Ivan struck, he would leave himself vulnerable on the other side. Only if he had absolute power could he deal with this many-headed hydra. And he had no such power. Ivan brooded until the morning of December 3rd, 1564, when the citizens of Moscow awoke to a strange sight. Hundreds of sleds filled the square before the Kremlin, loaded with the Tsar's treasures and with provisions for the entire court. They watched in disbelief as the Tsar and his court boarded the sleds and left town. Without explaining why, he established himself in a village south of Moscow. For an entire month, a kind of terror gripped the capital, for the Muscovites feared that Ivan had abandoned them to the bloodthirsty boyars. Shops closed up, and riotous mobs gathered daily. Finally, on January 3rd of 1565, a letter arrived from the Tsar explaining that he could no longer bear the boyars' betrayals and had decided to abdicate once and for all. Read aloud in public, the letter had a startling effect. Merchants and commoners blamed the boyars for Ivan's decision and took to the streets, terrifying the nobility with their fury. Soon a group of delegates representing the church, the princes, and the people made the journey to Ivan's village and begged the Tsar, in the name of the Holy Land of Russia, to return to the throne. Ivan listened but would not change his mind. After days of hearing their pleas, however, he offered his subjects a choice. Either they grant him absolute powers to govern as he pleased, with no interference from the boyars, or they find a new leader. Faced with a choice between civil war and the acceptance of despotic power, almost every sector of Russian society opted for a strong Tsar, calling for Ivan's return to Moscow and the restoration of law and order. In February, with much celebration, Ivan returned to Moscow. The Russians could no longer complain if he behaved dictatorially. They had given him this power themselves. Interpretation. Ivan the Terrible faced a terrible dilemma. To give in to the boyars would lead to certain destruction, but civil war would bring a different kind of ruin. Even if Ivan came out of such a war on top, the country would be devastated, and its divisions would be stronger than ever. His weapon of choice in the past had been to make a bold, offensive move. Now, however, that kind of move would turn against him. The more boldly he confronted his enemies, the worse the reactions it would spark. The main weakness in a show of force is that it stirs up resentment and eventually leads to a response that eats at your authority. Ivan, immensely creative in the use of power, saw clearly that the only path to the kind of victory he wanted was a false withdrawal. He would not force the country over to his position. He would give it options. Either his abdication and certain anarchy, or his accession to absolute power. To back up his move, he made it clear that he preferred to abdicate. "Call my bluff," he said, "and watch what happens." No one called his bluff. By withdrawing for just a month, he showed the country a glimpse of the nightmares that would follow his abdication. Tartar invasions, civil war, ruin. All of these did eventually come to pass after Ivan's death in the infamous Time of the Troubles. Withdrawal and disappearance are classic ways of controlling the options. You give people a sense of how things will fall apart without you, and you offer them a choice. I stay away and you suffer the consequences, or I return under circumstances that I dictate. In this method of controlling people's options, they choose the option that gives you power, because the alternative is just too unpleasant. You force their hand, but indirectly. They seem to have a choice. Whenever people feel they have a choice, they walk into your trap that much more easily. Observance of the Law Number 2. As a 17th-century French courtesan, Ninon de l'Enclos found that her life had certain pleasures. Her lovers came from royalty and aristocracy, and they paid her well, entertained her with their wit and intellect, satisfied her rather demanding sensual needs, and treated her almost as an equal. Such a life was infinitely preferable to marriage. In 1643, however, Ninon's mother died suddenly, leaving her, at the age of 23, totally alone in the world. No family, no dowry, nothing to fall back upon. A kind of panic overtook her, and she entered a convent, turning her back on her illustrious lovers. A year later she left the convent and moved to Lyon. When she finally reappeared in Paris in 1648, lovers and suitors flocked to her door in greater numbers than ever before, for she was the wittiest and most spirited courtesan of the time, and her presence had been greatly missed. Ninon's followers quickly discovered, however, that she had changed her old way of doing things, and had set up a new system of options. The dukes, seigneurs, and princes who wanted to pay for her services could continue to do so, but they were no longer in control. She would sleep with them when she wanted, according to her whim. All their money bought them was a possibility. If it was her pleasure to sleep with them only once a month, so be it. Those who did not want to be what Ninon called a payeur could join the large and growing group of men she called her martyrs, men who visited her apartment principally for her friendship, her biting wit, her lute-playing, in the company of the most vibrant minds of the period, including Molière, La Rochefoucauld, and Saint-Evremond. The martyrs, too, however, entertained a possibility. She would regularly select from them a favori, a man who would become her lover without having to pay, and to whom she would abandon herself completely for as long as she so desired. A week, a few months, rarely longer. A payeur could not become a favori, but a martyr had no guarantee of becoming one, and indeed could remain disappointed for an entire lifetime. The poet Charlevoix, for example, never enjoyed Ninon's favors, but never stopped coming to visit. He did not want to do without her company. As word of the system reached polite French society, Ninon became an object of intense hostility. Her reversal of the position of the courtesan scandalized the queen mother and her court. Much to their horror, however, it did not discourage her male suitors. Indeed, it only increased their numbers and intensified their desire. It became an honor to be a payeur, helping Ninon to maintain her lifestyle and her glittering salon, accompanying her sometimes to the theater, and sleeping with her when she chose. Even more distinguished were the martyrs, enjoying her company without paying for it, and maintaining the hope, however remote, of someday becoming her favori. That possibility spurred on many a young nobleman, as word spread that none among the courtesans could surpass Ninon in the art of love. And so the married and the single, the old and the young, entered her web and chose one of the two options presented to them, both of which amply satisfied her. Interpretation. The life of the courtesan entailed the possibility of a power that was denied a married woman, but it also had obvious perils. The man who paid for the courtesan's services in essence owned her, determining when he could possess her and when, later on, he would abandon her. As she grew older, her options narrowed as fewer men chose her. To avoid a life of poverty, she had to amass her fortune while she was young. The courtesan's legendary greed, then, reflected a practical necessity, yet also lessened her allure, since the illusion of being desired is important to men, who are often alienated if their partner is too interested in their money. As the courtesan aged, then, she faced a most difficult fate. Ninon de l'Enclos had a horror of any kind of dependence. She early on tasted a kind of equality with her lovers, and she would not settle into a system that left her such distasteful options. Strangely enough, the system she devised in its place seemed to satisfy her suitors as much as it did her. The payeurs may have had to pay, but the fact that Ninon would only sleep with them when she wanted to gave them a thrill unavailable with every other courtesan. She was yielding out of her own desire. The martyr's avoidance of the taint of having to pay gave them a sense of superiority. As members of Ninon's fraternity of admirers, they also might someday experience the ultimate pleasure of being her favori. Finally, Ninon did not force her suitors into either category. They could choose which side they preferred, a freedom that left them a vestige of masculine pride. Such is the power of giving people a choice, or rather the illusion of one, for they are playing with cards you have dealt them. Where the alternative set up by Ivan the Terrible involved a certain risk, one option would have led to his losing his power, Ninon created a situation in which every option redounded to her favor. From the payeurs she received the money she needed to run her salon, and from the martyrs she gained the ultimate in power. Power. She could surround herself with a bevy of admirers, a harem from which to choose her lovers. The system, though, depended on one critical factor— the possibility, however remote, that a martyr could become a favori. The illusion that riches, glory, or sensual satisfaction may someday fall into your victim's lap is an irresistible carrot to include in your list of choices. That hope, however slim, will make men accept the most ridiculous situations, because it leaves them the all-important option of a dream. The illusion of choice, married to the possibility of future good fortune, will lure the most stubborn sucker into your glittering web. Keys to Power. Words like freedom, options, and choice evoke a power of possibility far beyond the reality of the benefits they entail. When examined closely, the choices we have, in the marketplace, in elections, in our jobs, tend to have noticeable limitations. They are often a matter of a choice simply between A and B, with the rest of the alphabet left out of the picture. Yet as long as the faintest mirage of choice flickers on, we rarely focus on the missing options. We choose to believe that the game is fair, and that we have our freedom. We prefer not to think too much about the depth of our liberty to choose. This unwillingness to probe the smallness of our choices stems from the fact that too much freedom creates a kind of anxiety. The phrase unlimited options sounds infinitely promising, but unlimited options would actually paralyze us and cloud our ability to choose. Our limited range of choices comforts us. This supplies the clever and cunning with enormous opportunities for deception. For people who are choosing between alternatives find it hard to believe they are being manipulated or deceived. They cannot see that you are allowing them a small amount of free will in exchange for a much more powerful imposition of your own will. Setting up a narrow range of choices, then, should always be a part of your deceptions. There is a saying, if you can get the bird to walk into the cage on its own, it will sing that much more prettily. The following are among the most common forms of controlling the options. Color the choices. This was a favorite technique of Henry Kissinger. As President Richard Nixon's Secretary of State, Kissinger considered himself better informed than his boss, and believed that in most situations he could make the best decision on his own. But if he tried to determine policy, he would offend or perhaps enrage a notoriously insecure man. So Kissinger would propose three or four choices of action for each situation, and would present them in such a way that the one he preferred always seemed the best solution compared to the others. Time after time, Nixon fell for the bait, never suspecting that he was moving where Kissinger pushed him. This is an excellent device to use on an insecure master. Force the resistor. One of the main problems faced by Dr. Milton H. Erickson, a pioneer of hypnosis therapy in the 1950s, was the relapse. His patients might seem to be recovering rapidly, but their apparent susceptibility to the therapy masked a deep resistance. They would soon relapse into old habits, blame the doctor, and stop coming to see him. To avoid this, Erickson began ordering some patients to have a relapse, to make themselves feel as bad as when they first came in, to go back to square one. Faced with this option, the patients would usually choose to avoid the relapse, which, of course, was what Erickson really wanted. This is a good technique to use on children and other willful people who enjoy doing the opposite of what you ask them to. Push them to choose what you want them to do by appearing to advocate the opposite. Alter the playing field. In the 1860s, John D. Rockefeller set out to create an oil monopoly. If he tried to buy up the smaller oil companies, they would figure out what he was doing and fight back. Instead, he began secretly buying up the railway companies that transported the oil. When he then attempted to take over a particular company and met with resistance, he reminded them of their dependence on the rails. Refusing them shipping or simply raising their fees could ruin their business. Rockefeller altered the playing field so that the only options the small oil producers had were the ones he gave them. In this tactic, your opponents know their hand is being forced, but it doesn't matter. The technique is effective against those who resist at all costs. The shrinking options. The late 19th century art dealer, Ambroise Vollard, perfected this technique. Customers would come to Vollard's shop to see some Cézannes. He would show three paintings, neglect to mention a price, and pretend to doze off. The visitors would have to leave without deciding. They would usually come back the next day to see the paintings again. But this time, Vollard would pull out less interesting works, pretending he thought they were the same ones. The baffled customers would look at the new offerings, leave to think them over, and return yet again. Once again, the same thing would happen. Vollard would show paintings of lesser quality still. Finally, the buyers would realize they had better grab what he was showing them, because tomorrow they would have to settle for something worse, perhaps at even higher prices. A variation on this technique is to raise the price every time the buyer hesitates and another day goes by. This is an excellent negotiating ploy to use on the chronically indecisive, who will fall for the idea that they are getting a better deal today than if they wait till tomorrow. The weak man on the precipice. The weak are the easiest to maneuver by controlling their options. Cardinal de Retz, the great 17th century provocateur, served as an unofficial assistant to the Duke of Orléans, who was notoriously indecisive. It was a constant struggle to convince the Duke to take action. He would hem and haw, weigh the options, and wait till the last moment, giving everyone around him an ulcer. But Retz discovered a way to handle him. He would describe all sorts of dangers, exaggerating them as much as possible, until the Duke saw a yawning abyss in every direction except one, the one Retz was pushing him to take. This tactic is similar to color the choices, but with the weak, you have to be more aggressive. Work on their emotions. Use fear and terror to propel them into action. Try reason, and they will always find a way to procrastinate. Brothers in crime. This is a classic con artist technique. You attract your victims to some criminal scheme, creating a bond of blood and guilt between you. They participate in your deception, commit a crime, and are easily manipulated. Serge Stavisky, the great French con artist of the 1920s, so entangled the government in his scams and swindles that the state did not dare prosecute him, and chose to leave him alone. It is often wise to implicate in your deceptions the very person who can do you the most harm if you fail. Their involvement can be subtle. Even a hint of their involvement will narrow their options and buy their silence. The horns of a dilemma. This idea was demonstrated by General William Sherman's infamous march through Georgia during the American Civil War. Although the Confederates knew what direction Sherman was heading in, they never knew if he would attack from the left or the right, for he divided his army into two wings. And if the rebels retreated from one wing, they found themselves facing the other. This is a classic trial lawyer's technique. The lawyer leads the witnesses to decide between two possible explanations of an event, both of which poke a hole in their story. They have to answer the lawyer's questions, but whatever they say, they hurt themselves. The key to this move is to strike quickly. Deny the victim the time to think of an escape. As they wriggle between the horns of the dilemma, they dig their own grave. Understand, in your struggles with your rivals, it will often be necessary for you to hurt them. And if you are clearly the agent of their punishment, expect a counterattack. Expect revenge. If, however, they seem to themselves to be the agents of their own misfortune, they will submit quietly. When Ivan left Moscow for his rural village, the citizens asking him to return agreed to his demand for absolute power. Over the years to come, they resented him less for the terror he unleashed on the country, because, after all, they had granted him his power themselves. This is why it is always good to allow your victims their choice of poison, and to cloak your involvement in providing it to them as far as possible. Reversal. Controlling the options has one main purpose: to disguise yourself as the agent of power and punishment. The tactic works best, then, for those whose power is fragile, and who cannot operate too openly without incurring suspicion, resentment, and anger. Even as a general rule, however, it is rarely wise to be seen as exerting power directly and forcefully, no matter how secure or strong you are. It is usually more elegant and more effective to give people the illusion of choice. On the other hand, by limiting other people's options, you sometimes limit your own. There are situations in which it is to your advantage to allow your rivals a large degree of freedom. As you watch them operate, you give yourself rich opportunities to spy, gather information, and plan your deceptions. The 19th-century banker James Rothschild liked this method. He felt that if he tried to control his opponent's movements, he lost the chance to observe their strategy and plan a more effective course. The more freedom he allowed them in the short term, the more forcefully he could act against them in the long run. Here are some further reflections on this law. From the Little Brown Book of Anecdotes. The German Chancellor Bismarck, enraged at the constant criticisms from Rudolf Virchow, the German pathologist and liberal politician, had his seconds call upon the scientist to challenge him to a duel. "As the challenge party, I have the choice of weapons," said Virchow, "and I choose these." He held aloft two large and apparently identical sausages. "One of these," he went on, "is infected with deadly germs. The other is perfectly sound. Let His Excellency decide which one he wishes to eat, and I will eat the other." Almost immediately the message came back that the Chancellor had decided to cancel the duel. From an Armenian folktale. The Liar. Once upon a time there was a king of Armenia who, being of a curious turn of mind and in need of some new diversion, sent his heralds throughout the land to make the following proclamation. "Hear this. Whatever man among you can prove himself the most outrageous liar in Armenia shall receive an apple made of pure gold from the hands of His Majesty the King." People began to swarm to the palace from every town and hamlet in the country. People of all ranks and conditions. Princes, merchants, farmers, priests, rich and poor, tall and short, fat and thin. There was no lack of liars in the land, and each one told his tale to the king. A ruler, however, has heard practically every sort of lie, and none of those now told him convinced the king that he had listened to the best of them. The king was beginning to grow tired of his new sport, and was thinking of calling the whole contest off without declaring a winner, when there appeared before him a poor, ragged man carrying a large earthenware pitcher under his arm. "What can I do for you?" asked His Majesty. "Sire," said the poor man, slightly bewildered, "surely, remember, you owe me a pot of gold, and I have come to collect it." "You are a perfect liar, sir," exclaimed the king. "I owe you no money." "A perfect liar, am I?" said the poor man. "Then give me the golden apple." The king, realizing that the man was trying to trick him, started to hedge. "No, no, you are not a liar." "Then give me the pot of gold you owe me, sire," said the man. The king saw the dilemma. He handed over the golden apple. From the Little Brown Book of Anecdotes. J.P. Morgan Sr. once told a jeweler of his acquaintance that he was interested in buying a pearl scarf pin. Just a few weeks later, the jeweler happened upon a magnificent pearl. He had it mounted in an appropriate setting and sent it to Morgan, together with a bill for $5,000. The following day, the package was returned. Morgan's accompanying note read, "I like the pin, but I don't like the price. If you will accept the enclosed check for $4,000, please send back the box with the seal unbroken." The enraged jeweler refused the check and dismissed the messenger in disgust. He opened up the box to reclaim the unwanted pin, only to find that it had been removed. In its place was a check for $5,000. The 32nd Law. Play to People's Fantasies. Judgment. The truth is often avoided because it is ugly and unpleasant. Never appeal to truth and reality unless you are prepared for the anger that comes from disenchantment. Life is so harsh and distressing that people who can manufacture romance or conjure up fantasy are like oases in the desert. Everyone flocks to them. There is great power in tapping into the fantasies of the masses. Observance of the law. The city-state of Venice was prosperous for so long that its citizens felt their small republic had destiny on its side. In the Middle Ages and High Renaissance, its virtual monopoly on trade to the east made it the wealthiest city in Europe. Under a beneficent republican government, Venetians enjoyed liberties that few other Italians had ever known. Yet in the 16th century, their fortunes suddenly changed. The opening of the New World transferred power to the Atlantic side of Europe, to the Spanish and Portuguese, and later the Dutch and English. Venice could not compete economically, and its empire gradually dwindled. The final blow was the devastating loss of a prized Mediterranean possession, the island of Cyprus, captured from Venice by the Turks in 1570. Now noble families went broke in Venice, and banks began to fold. A kind of gloom and depression settled over the citizens. They had known a glittering past, had either lived through it or heard stories about it from their elders. The closeness of the glory years was humiliating. The Venetians half believed that the goddess Fortune was only playing a joke on them, and that the old days would soon return. For the time being, though, what could they do? In 1589, rumors began to swirl around Venice of the arrival, not far away, of a mysterious man called Il Bragadino, a master of alchemy. A man who had won incredible wealth through his ability, it was said, to multiply gold through the use of a secret substance. The rumors spread quickly because a few years earlier, a Venetian nobleman passing through Poland had heard a learned man prophesy that Venice would recover her past glory and power if she could find a man who understood the alchemic art of manufacturing gold. And so, as word reached Venice of the gold this Bragadino possessed, he clinked gold coins continuously in his hands, and golden objects filled his palace. Some began to dream. Through him, their city would prosper again. Members of Venice's most important noble families accordingly went together to Brescia, where Bragadino lived. They toured his palace and watched in awe as he demonstrated his gold-making abilities, taking a pinch of seemingly worthless minerals and transforming it into several ounces of gold dust. The Venetian Senate prepared to debate the idea of extending an official invitation to Bragadino to stay in Venice at the city's expense, when word suddenly reached them that they were competing with the Duke of Mantua for his services. They heard of a magnificent party in Bragadino's palace for the Duke, featuring garments with golden buttons, gold watches, gold plates, and on and on. Worried they might lose Bragadino to Mantua, the Senate voted almost unanimously to invite him to Venice, promising him the mountain of money he would need to continue living in his luxurious style, but only if he came right away. Late that year, the mysterious Bragadino arrived in Venice. With his piercing dark eyes under thick brows and the two enormous black mastiffs that accompanied him everywhere, he was forbidding and impressive. He took up residence in a sumptuous palace on the island of Giudecca, with the Republic funding his banquets, his expensive clothes, and all his other whims. A kind of alchemy fever spread through Venice. On street corners, hawkers would sell coal, distilling apparatus, bellows, how-to books on the subject. Everyone began to practice alchemy. Everyone except Bragadino. The alchemist seemed to be in no hurry to begin manufacturing the gold that would save Venice from ruin. Strangely enough, this only increased his popularity and following. People thronged from all over Europe, even Asia, to meet this remarkable man. Months went by, with gifts pouring in to Bragadino from all sides. Still, he gave no sign of the miracle that the Venetians confidently expected him to produce. Eventually, the citizens began to grow impatient, wondering if he would wait forever. At first, the senators warned them not to hurry him. He was a capricious devil who needed to be cajoled. Finally, though, the nobility began to wonder, too, and the Senate came under pressure to show a return on the city's ballooning investment. Bragadino had only scorn for the doubters, but he responded to them. He had, he said, already deposited in the city's mint the mysterious substance with which he multiplied gold. He could use this substance up all at once and produce double the gold, but the more slowly the process took place, the more it would yield. If left alone for 7 years, sealed in a casket, the substance would multiply the gold in the mint 30 times over. Most of the senators agreed to wait to reap the gold mine Bragadino promised. Others, however, were angry. 7 more years of this man living royally at the public trough. And many of the common citizens of Venice echoed these sentiments. Finally, the alchemist's enemies demanded he produce a proof of his skills, a substantial amount of gold, and soon. Lofty, apparently devoted to his art, Bragadino responded that Venice, in its impatience, had betrayed him, and would therefore lose his services. He left town, going first to nearby Padua, then, in 1590, to Munich, at the invitation of the Duke of Bavaria, who, like the entire city of Venice, had known great wealth but had fallen into bankruptcy through his own profligacy, and hoped to regain his fortune through the famous alchemist's services. And so Bragadino resumed the comfortable arrangement he had known in Venice, and the same pattern repeated itself. Interpretation. The young Cypriot Mamunia had lived in Venice for several years before reincarnating himself as the alchemist Bragadino. He saw how gloom had settled on the city, how everyone was hoping for a redemption from some indefinite source, while other charlatans mastered everyday cons based on sleight of hand. Mamunia mastered human nature. With Venice as his target from the start, he traveled abroad, made some money through his alchemy scams, and then returned to Italy, setting up shop in Brescia. There he created a reputation that he knew would spread to Venice. From a distance, in fact, his aura of power would be all the more impressive. At first, Mamunia did not use vulgar demonstrations to convince people of his alchemic skill. His sumptuous palace, his opulent garments, the clink of gold in his hands, all these provided a superior argument to anything rational. And these established the cycle that kept him going. His obvious wealth confirmed his reputation as an alchemist, so that patrons like the Duke of Mantua gave him money, which allowed him to live in wealth, which reinforced his reputation as an alchemist, and so on. Only once his reputation was established, and dukes and senators were fighting over him, did he resort to the trifling necessity of a demonstration. By then, however, people were easy to deceive. They wanted to believe. The Venetian senators who watched him multiply gold wanted to believe so badly that they failed to notice the glass pipe up its sleeve, from which he slipped gold dust into its pinches of minerals. Brilliant and capricious, he was the alchemist of their fantasies. And once he had created an aura like this, no one noticed his simple deceptions. Such is the power of the fantasies that take root in us, especially in times of scarcity and decline. People rarely believe that their problems arise from their own misdeeds and stupidity. Someone or something out there is to blame. The other, the world, the gods. And so salvation comes from the outside as well. Had Bragadino arrived in Venice armed with a detailed analysis of the reasons behind the city's economic decline, and of the hard-nosed steps that it could take to turn things around, he would have been scorned. The reality was too ugly and the solution too painful, mostly the kind of hard work that the citizens' ancestors had mustered to create an empire. Fantasy, on the other hand, in this case the romance of alchemy, was easy to understand and infinitely more palatable. To gain power, you must be a source of pleasure for those around you. And pleasure comes from playing to people's fantasies. Never promise a gradual improvement through hard work. Rather, promise the moon, the great and sudden transformation, the pot of gold. As David Hume said, "No man need despair of gaining converts to the most extravagant hypothesis who has art enough to represent it in favorable colors." Keys to power. Fantasy can never operate alone. It requires the backdrop of the humdrum and the mundane. It is the oppressiveness of reality that allows fantasy to take root and bloom. In 16th century Venice, the reality was one of decline and loss of prestige. The corresponding fantasy described a sudden recovery of past glories through the miracle of alchemy. While the reality only got worse, the Venetians inhabited a happy dream world in which their city restored its fabulous wealth and power overnight, turning dust into gold. The person who can spin a fantasy out of an oppressive reality has access to untold power. As you search for the fantasy that will take hold of the masses, then keep your eye on the banal truths that weigh heavily on us all. Never be distracted by people's glamorous portraits of themselves and their lives. Search and dig for what really imprisons them. Once you find that, you have the magical key that will put great power in your hands. Although times and people change, let us examine a few of the oppressive realities that endure, and the opportunities for power they provide. The reality. Change is slow and gradual. It requires hard work, a bit of luck, a fair amount of self-sacrifice, and a lot of patience. The fantasy. A sudden transformation will bring total change in one's fortunes, bypassing work, luck, self-sacrifice, and time in one fantastic stroke. This is, of course, the fantasy par excellence of the charlatans who prowl among us to this day, and was the key to Bragadino's success. Promise a great and total change, from poor to rich, sickness to health, misery to ecstasy, and you will have followers. How did the great 16th century German quack, Leonhard Tyrneiser, become the court physician for the Elector of Brandenburg without ever studying medicine? Instead of offering amputations, leeches, and foul-tasting purgatives, the medicaments of the time, Tyrneiser offered sweet-tasting elixirs and promised instant recovery. Fashionable courtiers especially wanted his solution of drinkable gold, which cost a fortune. If some inexplicable illness assailed you, Tyrneiser would consult a horoscope and prescribe a talisman. Who could resist such a fantasy? Health and well-being without sacrifice and pain. The reality. The social realm has hard-set codes and boundaries. We understand these limits, and know that we have to move within the same familiar circles day in and day out. The fantasy. We can enter a totally new world with different codes and the promise of adventure. In the early 1700s, all London was abuzz with talk of a mysterious stranger. A young man named George Salmoneser. He had arrived from what was to most Englishmen a fantastical land, the island of Formosa, now Taiwan, off the coast of China. Oxford University engaged Salmoneser to teach the island's language. A few years later, he translated the Bible into Formosan, then wrote a book, an immediate bestseller on Formosa's history and geography. English royalty wined and dined the young man, and everywhere he went, he entertained his hosts with wondrous stories of his homeland and its bizarre customs. After Salmoneser died, however, his will revealed that he was in fact merely a Frenchman with a rich imagination. Everything he had said about Formosa, its alphabet, its language, its literature, its entire culture, he had invented. He had built on the English public's ignorance of the place to concoct an elaborate story that fulfilled their desire for the exotic and strange. British culture's rigid control of people's dangerous dreams gave him the perfect opportunity to exploit their fantasy. The fantasy of the exotic, of course, can also skirt the sexual. It must not come too close, though, for the physical hinders the power of fantasy. It can be seen, grasped, and then tired of. The fate of most courtesans. The bodily charms of the mistress only whet the master's appetite for more and different pleasures, a new beauty to adore. To bring power, fantasy must remain to some degree unrealized, literally unreal. The dancer Mata Hari, for instance, who rose to public prominence in Paris before World War I, had quite ordinary looks. Her power came from the fantasy she created of being strange and exotic, unknowable and indecipherable. The taboo she worked with was less sex itself than the breaking of social codes. Another form of the fantasy of the exotic is simply the hope for relief from boredom. Con artists love to play on the oppressiveness of the working world, its lack of adventure. Their cons might involve, say, the recovering of lost Spanish treasure, with the possible participation of an alluring Mexican señorita, and a connection to the president of a South American country. Anything offering release from the humdrum. The reality. Society is fragmented and full of conflict. The fantasy. People can come together in a mystical union of souls. In the 1920s, the con man Oscar Hartzell made a quick fortune out of the age-old Sir Francis Drake swindle, basically promising any sucker who happened to be surnamed Drake a substantial share of the long-lost Drake treasure to which Hartzell had access. Thousands across the Midwest fell for the scam, which Hartzell cleverly turned into a crusade against the government and everyone else who was trying to keep the Drake fortune out of the rightful hands of its heirs. There developed a mystical union of the oppressed Drakes, with emotional rallies and meetings. Promise such a union and you can gain much power. But it is a dangerous power that can easily turn against you. This is a fantasy for demagogues to play on. The reality. Death. The dead cannot be brought back. The past cannot be changed. The fantasy. A sudden reversal of this intolerable fact. This con has many variations, but requires great skill and subtlety. The beauty and importance of the art of Vermeer have long been recognized, but his paintings are small in number and are extremely rare. In the 1930s, though, Vermeers began to appear in the art market. Experts were called upon to verify them and pronounce them real. Possession of these new Vermeers would crown a collector's career. It was like the resurrection of Lazarus. In a strange way, Vermeer had been brought back to life. The past had been changed. Only later did it come out that the new Vermeers were the work of a middle-aged Dutch forger named Han van Meekeren. He had chosen Vermeer for his scam because he understood fantasy. The paintings would seem real precisely because the public and the experts as well so desperately wanted to believe they were. Remember, the key to fantasy is distance. The distant has allure and promise. Seems simple and problem-free. What you are offering then should be ungraspable. Never let it become oppressively familiar. It is the mirage in the distance, withdrawing as the sucker approaches. Never be too direct in describing the fantasy. Keep it vague. As a forger of fantasies, let your victim come close to see and be tempted, but keep him far away enough that he stays dreaming and desiring. Reversal. If there is power in tapping into the fantasies of the masses, there is also danger. Fantasy usually contains an element of play. The public half realizes it's being duped, but it keeps the dream alive anyway, relishing the entertainment and the temporary diversion from the everyday that you are providing. So keep it light. Never come too close to the place where you are actually expected to produce results. That place may prove extremely hazardous. After Bragadino established himself in Munich, he found that the sober-minded Bavarians had far less faith in alchemy than the temperamental Venetians. Only the Duke really believed in it, for he needed it desperately to rescue him from the hopeless mess he was in. As Bragadino played his familiar waiting game, accepting gifts and expecting patience, the public grew angry. Money was being spent and was yielding no results. In 1592, the Bavarians demanded justice, and eventually Bragadino found himself swinging from the gallows. As before, he had promised and had not delivered.